comes from the a Pottery Barn CD that I picked up at the place in which I live, and that my dear, dear pal Kathy Murray must have bought many years ago. I don't think I've ever been in a Pottery Barn, but I have been a fan of the work of Libby Fisher-Hellman for a very, very long time. Libby, I made the difficult choice to tell you to stay home because it's freezing out. It would be great to see you face-to-face, but it's always a joy to read you. You know that. Your latest is High Crimes, which features one of my favorite detectives in the world, Georgia Davis. Before we talk specifically about this book, you have had an estimable... Couldn't have been easy all the time, and I do want to talk a bit about the changing nature of the publishing business.
Sure.
But you've had an estimable career since moving here 35 years ago. You used to be in the TV business, right? What did you do?
I was an associate producer at PBS.
Mm-hmm.
I was an editor, a desk editor at NBC in Washington. I was a talent coordinator for Good Morning America for all of about 6 weeks. I had a lot of jobs in 8 years, and that was one of the reasons why I got out of it eventually.
Why Chicago?
Someone offered me a job at a big PR firm called Burson Marsteller.
Wow.
And I didn't have anything else to do that day, so I said, yeah.
Well, but you obviously, I think it's such a wonderful marriage, if I can use that word, you and this city, because you have plumbed this city in such a literate and exciting kind of way. You found in Chicago a perfect, I think, setting for your work. Did you not?
I did.
Yeah.
And part of it is having come here all those years ago as an outsider and looking at the city and what went on there as an outsider. And I hope to some extent I still have that. I know that Georgia has that.
But oh, no question.
Personality.
Sure. Sure.
Yes.
When did you first start? Take me back. I know we probably discussed this a million times, but it's been a while. Take me back to when you first began to write crime.
It was here in Chicago. I had never thought of becoming a writer, although I did a lot of writing,
sure,
both in broadcast TV. News
sure.
And in the public relations business. But it was all nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
Never even thought of writing fiction. The turning point, really, I don't know if I've told you this, was the O.J. Simpson trial.
No, you never did.
You know, I was watching it. I was freelancing. I had left Burson after about 8 years. I needed to stay there to prove to myself that I could hold a job for more than a year and a half. And I was at home with my kids, and I would watch the trial during the day. And I was, first of all, the cast of characters was out of, like,
exactly.
You know, central casting.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the earnest prosecutor, the avuncular F. Lee Bailey, the surfer dude,
mm-hmm.
the football hero. I mean, you couldn't have asked for a better setup. And then there was the big thing was the world of forensics that trial introduced me to. I had no idea that police could analyze blood spatters and find out how the stab wound had occurred. I had no idea that they could take a shoe print of a size, whatever it was,
yeah, right.
Bruno Mali shoe, and figure out what size it was. I had no idea that, we all knew about DNA back then, but there were so many other things that I didn't know about that it was like magic. And I was entranced by it.
Well,
and then, of course, the ending, the denouement, was just, you know.
Too much. Too much.
Yeah. You know, the acquittal was just amazing.
How did you then, Libby, and you have an extraordinarily good website, Libby, Libby, Hellman, Hellmann.com. It is a great website. And one of the reasons is we will get to in a while because the changing nature of publishing over the last since you watched the OJ trial, let's say. When did you put fingers to computer keyboard or pen to paper after that?
4 months after that. My father died in the interim, and we went to Washington for the funeral, which is where I grew up.
Sure.
And when I got back, I went down into my basement, and 4 months later, I emerged with arguably the worst mystery that has ever been written. It is so bad that I tried to take a look at it, maybe about after I'd published 5 or 6 novels. Yeah. I said, well, maybe
there's something there. Maybe there's something there.
I got to page 25. I said, this is so bad. But, of course, at the time, I didn't know what I didn't know.
Sure.
Well, so I was lucky enough to join a wonderful writers group, stayed in it for actually 20 years.
Wow.
And the fourth book that I wrote was the first book that was published. Ah. It became An Eye for Murder.
Wow. I remember that one. That was a good book.
That was Ellie Foreman.
Well, did you? That's Libby's other female detective. You must have been in part, or maybe you didn't even know Sarah Paretsky at the time, or know of Sarah. Did you?
I knew of her, and after I got interested in mysteries, I read a lot of her books, and now we're pretty friendly. And then I followed her. Well, she founded Sisters in Crime,
which you later became president.
Right, exactly. So we have connections there, and we also have. I would say that I love it when people say to me, "Oh, you write like Sarah Paretsky," because
that's
biggest compliments you could pay me.
No, I think it's a nice compliment, but I don't think that I've read both of you at length, and I don't think that's true at all. You both have very, very, you have distinctive styles that are your own. I love Sarah, too, but I
I'm reading her new book right now, Shell Game. I'm going to interview her next month.
Oh, how nice. One of the great things about Chicago that I have ever felt, certainly in the crime, and I use crime as a very big umbrella, is it can be, and you may speak to this too, your own career may speak to this, is it can be a very nurturing environment, can't it?
Well, the people here are absolutely wonderful people, very generous with their time and with their knowledge, and particularly here in Chicago, but pretty much all over, everyone is pretty good, pretty friendly, and pretty people that you can trust. And then there's all the people that surround the community, all the experts, all the policemen, all the trial attorneys, all the experts in DNA and now cybersecurity. And they're sort of the outer ring of the community,
sure.
And everyone knows who to call. And if I need an expert in a certain area, you know, I make 2 phone calls or 2 emails, and I have it by the end of the day.
That's pretty amazing. What do you think it is? And I know a lot of those guys, too, and they mostly are. They mostly are guys. I don't mean to be sexist here.
No.
But what do you think it is that compels some of those experts in various fields to so eagerly share their expertise?
Because they want you to get it right. When you're writing, and when you're writing about crime, or you're writing about cybersecurity, or you're writing about a specific location, they want you to get it right. And we want to get it right, because we don't want that expert to throw our books against the wall afterwards and say, she doesn't know what she's talking about. I tried to teach her, but she wouldn't listen. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do know what you mean. Yeah. This is, according to your website or some other place I found this, your 15th. Talk to me before we take a break, because I'm keeping you on all the way to 11 to talk about this specific book, High Crime. This isn't one of those, hey, tell me what your book's about interviews. It's going to get a little more in-depth here. This the whole, especially, and we'll get into this later in the show, but the whole nature of publishing where thriller is thriller, crime is crime, suspense is suspense. You have to be kind of pigeonholed when I consider everything you write under the big umbrella, you and Marcus Sakey and Sarah Paretsky under crime. Does that offend mm-hmm. you, or how do you feel about that?
Absolutely. I think there needs to be a big umbrella because...
Yeah, good, good.
Yeah, when you pigeonhole authors, it's bad for you because you may not reach out as much and enjoy people that are writing slightly differently than you
right,
are.
Right, right.
And it's bad for us because we don't want to be pigeonholed.
Yeah,
so.
exactly.
Yeah.
There are so many more, and I find this to be true. Many over the last 10 years, I would hazard to say that I know more women drawn to the crime genre than I have known men. Am I running in the wrong
direction? Accurate. Crime? The problem is that a lot of women write cozies, and that's a very specific niche of the market that is mostly appealing to other women. When you write darker, like I do and
yes.
like Sarah does, it's a little more challenging because there we are up against the Dennis Lehanes, the Michael Connelly,
yeah.
the, you know, the Marcus Sakeys and Sean Chirkovers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like I feel like I have to earn my spurs.
Gotcha.
You know, I mean, it is male-female thing. How dark can you go and still be appealing to a broad market?
Yeah.
I mean, Gillian Flynn did a wonderful thing. Oh, and she opened up a whole new type of mystery or crime, which is called now domestic noir.
Is it really?
You know, and the unreliable narrator.
I thought it was to have girl in the title of your book. She did do that. And Gillian, too, as you will attest, Libby Fisher-Hellman, is like among the nicest people you'll ever meet.
Yeah, I mean,
it's like crazy. She's
I know. But there's something about before you go to break,
sure.
I do want to say that I think that crime fiction is probably one of the easiest ways to explore social issues and political issues and any kind of international issues, as long as you don't beat your reader over the head with it.
Yeah. Well,
I may have gone a little heavy-handed in high crimes, but there was a reason for it.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, this book was sort of, I have to believe it was kind of inspired by something that happened to you.
Well, we'll get into the backstory
that happened
to
you
on
Facebook.
I'd love to tell you and your listeners.
Well, now we're going to get deep into high crimes and the screwed-up world of contemporary publishing. Libby Fisher-Hellman and Rick Kogan will take that on. So please stay tuned, everybody. Libby will be on all the way till 11.
It's your thing. Do what you wanna do. I can't tell you who to sock it to. It's your thing. Do what you wanna do.
That again, ladies and gentlemen, from some CD I pulled from the bottom of the drawer. It's the Pottery Barn Soul. Thanks to Ernie Skatton enjoying the New England Patriots victory. Not because he loves the New England Patriots. He's a betting man, and he won a bet. He's the engineer of this show. Ben Anderson is the extremely talented producer of this show. I'm Rick Kogan, and my guest is Libby Hellman, and we're talking about her 15 books, by my count, the latest of which is High Crimes. Libby, you have created two female private eyes, I guess, or investigator.
Right.
Why two? Georgia Davis is the protagonist in High Crimes. Why two? You obviously now are at such a point where they're... Well, you know them both very, very well, and you may say to yourself, "Well, I think Georgia would be better for this story." Or how does that work?
That's not far from where I am. I when I get an idea, I automatically say, "Well, is this going to be a standalone, or is it going to be an Ellie book, or is it going to be a Georgia book?"
Yeah. Ellie Foreman
the
being
the reason that I have both of them is that, frankly, Ellie is an amateur sleuth.
Mm-hmm.
And after four books, it was getting pretty difficult to find a credible reason why a video producer would get into murder investigations.
Right.
I needed somebody whose job it was to do that, and therefore Georgia had been in a couple of Ellie books and played a fairly prominent role in the third book, and so I decided to suspend her from the police force, where she was an officer, and set up her own shop as a PI.
In one of the books, if we can talk for a second about one that, I mean, I have read, I do believe, all of your books, but one that really,
the kind man.
Really, well, one of the standalones, it's not kind at all. I mean, you're a very, very talented writer, and there's, you know, some of these are quite Chicago-centric.
Yes.
Set the Night on Fire was one that I still remember to this day. Talk about that book for a second.
You know, it's almost, the High Crimes and Set the Night on Fire are almost companion.
Yeah, I felt that, right.
Set the Night on Fire was set both in the present and in the late 60s.
Yep.
In the present, a young girl is being stalked. Someone's trying to kill her. She doesn't know who, and she doesn't know why. And in her increasingly desperate search to figure it out, she finds out that her parents were not the people she thought they were.
Right.
And then we go back to the late 60s, to the eve of the Democratic Convention in 68, and we follow six people who met oh so casually in the park and decided to live together.
Yeah.
In that very, you know, far out. Sure, why not?
Yeah, something I could have done if I had been about 3 years older at the time. Yeah.
Exactly. And during that part, we find out who her parents really were and why the secret had to be kept.
Yeah, it's a remarkable, remarkable
book. Thank you. It's very funny. I did listen to your previous interview with Barbara.
Oh, yeah.
And you were mentioning Rita Dragonette.
Right.
And I met her last week for the first time at the bookseller.
Come on.
Where she was talking about September 14th, and Susie had a copy of Set the Night on Fire. I said, hey, here you go.
Well, see, that's another thing. And one of the reasons I'm glad you stayed, and I'm glad you're here, and I'm sure you're glad why you stayed, this is a wonderfully, wonderfully small literary world. And you don't, it's not just, you know, a bunch of goofs, men and women, lining up at the bar at O'Rourke's anymore. It's, you know, you'll meet them out and about. To that end,
how did you know I used to hang out at O'Rourke's?
I know everybody used to hang out at O'Rourke's. Are you kidding me? And it was fun to hang out at O'Rourke's. There were a lot of, sadly, I think, Libby, as you well know, there are a lot of books that didn't get written because a lot of people hung out too long, much at O'Rourke's. But, and that whole, the whole literary bar scene has kind of evaporated. And sometimes you'll see some writers in the Old Town Ale House, but it ain't like the old days. And neither is the publishing business. I mean, I hate to keep beating this to death, but you, I think, are a great, great example of someone who has mastered, maybe not totally, but mastered the increasingly crazy world of publishing.
Thank you. I'm surviving.
Yeah,
I can tell you that.
Which is, to my mind, kind of mastering it. Yeah.
it's a tough world out there, and it gets tougher every day. I just wrote an article on for Crime Reads, which is a online magazine, and I found out a statistic that over 57,000 books are published every day.
Every day?
Every day. Yes. Millions and millions every year. It's unbelievable. I mean, it's unbelievable that anyone can make a living, can get a book out there that's going to be read.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, because you and I both, I mean, many of your books went the sort of conventional route, and by conventional, I mean the route that was the way of publishing. You would go get an agent. An agent would determine what would might be the best publishing house for this particular book, and then approach an editor there, and a deal would be made, and it was, if not...
Predictable.
It was occasionally substantial enough to allow you time to write your next book.
Right.
And you would have an editor and or editors there who would help nurture. True?
You have it. You have it down. It's very different now. I'm not averse to going back to traditional publishing if the book is a kind of evergreen story.
Right.
That it doesn't, you know, the being sort of a type A, I like to get my books out fairly promptly. And with a traditional publisher, you're going to wait for a year, a year and a half until the book comes out. Small publishers are better, more timely, but the big five are pretty slow. So particularly with High Crimes, I knew I had to self-publish it because I needed it to get out before the end of
2018. Certain term. Yes.
And I just made it under the wire.
Yeah. It was inspired. Again, it's a Chicago private eye named George Davis, who is on the trail of someone who, an assassin, I guess, and on the trail of, but also on the assassin of the assassin. A gunman is found in a roof of a hotel very close to Grant Park in Chicago. It involves sort of a search. Facebook becomes something of a villain in, or a, oh, I don't know how to put this. Facebook's not the villain itself, but the villain is hiding somewhere, somehow in Facebook. How did that come? Well, what's the inspiration for that? Because I think it's so fascinating.
Totally true to life.
Really?
I'll tell you a little of the backstory.
Sure.
After the election, I was shocked, just like the rest of the world.
Sure.
And then I went into a period of rage, although my rage lasted a year. I couldn't write. I couldn't do anything.
Oh,
all I could do was hang out on Twitter and Facebook and read articles and rant. I must have lost tons of friends who hid me on Facebook because I was so vocal. But one of the things I did a couple of days after the election, a new group, a Facebook group was formed, and it was called the Trump-Russia Investigation
into
the 2016 election. And the woman who started it, her name was Susie Fisher, and it was spelled the same way my name is, with a C. And so at the beginning, we were emailing or messaging, and I was saying, oh, you know, are we relatives or something? She said, no, we're not relatives. My father changed his name. But she shared my rage. And for a good 6 months, we were in touch almost daily about what was going on and what was happening to our country. And meanwhile, the Facebook group exploded. It went up to 42,000 people.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Now, they started to moderate it because there were a lot of trolls coming in and a lot of people who were pretending to be anti-Trump, but they really weren't. And when I finally decided after a year went by that I had been giving him too much of my power, I started to try to think about what I was going to write. And I'm scrolling through the posts on the Facebook group one night, and I say, wow, wait a minute. What if, which of course is the plotter's device that we always use,
what if
a woman started a Facebook group, it mushroomed to 42,000 people, and then she's murdered? Who would have done it and why?
Yeah.
And so the first thing I had to do was get in touch with Susie and say, I have an idea, it's based on the group. Would it be okay
if I killed you in the first chapter?
Borrow it, and can I talk about the person who created it? Unfortunately, she dies in the first chapter.
What did she say?
She said, fine.
Go.
She said, go for it. Oh. And I actually dedicated the book to her because she was my inspiration.
That is too priceless. I'm
looking for it. The group is still going strong. It's lost a few hundred members, but that's okay.
Well, you write in here for Susie Fisher, who for the past 2 years has provided a beacon lighting the way through the dark.
Yes.
This must have been a particularly, I don't know how fast you wrote this, Olivia, and I know that you are a professional, but this has a wonderful narrative drive. Was this easy? Was this an easy one to write for you?
You know, it was.
Yeah.
It was easier than some of the others. Once I finally figured out what I was going to write about.
Right.
I wrote half of it in a few months. Then I got stuck, as many writers do halfway through. And I went to help cat sit in France, in the south of France.
There's a novel.
Last July.
Yes, that sounds like a cozy to me. Yeah.
No, it was with British author Zoe Sharp. And she was going over there. She said, why don't you come with me? It's an expat British couple who are going away to Italy for a month, and we got ensconced there. There was no TV.
Oh,
there was no
God,
Trump. There were no
great
distractions. I wrote 25,000 words in 3 weeks and finished the book.
Wow.
Yeah. I have never had an experience like that before in my entire life where it just
flowed. The cat sitter. We got it, Libby. We got to take one short little break here and then come back. And I want to close off by asking you specifically about your website and how. I'll just ask the questions. I won't preload.
Okay.
We'll be back. Here we are with Rick Hogan, back for a few more minutes with Libby Fisher-Hellman. You must go to her website, which is a great website, Libby, L-I-B-B-Y, HELLMANN.com, to get a look at all of her books. It is a great, great website, which is a necessary element of being a writer these days, without a doubt. Libby, one of the things, even though my knees are weak over your discovery that there are 57,000 books published every day in this country, that will put I can just see some would-be writer out there stopping at his computer going, well, I don't know, I guess that won't work. I can't.
It's very tough. It's very challenging.
Well, your books will ever sell, but what about, how has it hurt you? I remember, you know, years ago, not that many years ago, when newspapers had book review sections, and there were some papers that paid special attention to local authors, even in a place as big as Chicago. Has that lack of attention hurt?
It hasn't helped.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the dearth of bookstores, you know, we were...
Yeah.
That hasn't helped either. And the growth of the internet, I mean, everybody is hawking their books, and everybody is doing a podcast, and everybody is doing Facebook ads, and so there's a real glut of everything in terms of social media and books and competition.
Yeah, I find it disturbing in that it's you know, kind of like the Facebook that you discover in your latest novel, High Crimes, where there's just so much noise out there that it's just very, very difficult for people to... How are they supposed to find the good writer? They can't walk in. I guess you could walk into a place like the bookstall or the bookseller and say, hey, I'm looking to find a really cool female detective, and they would be turned on to your work. But it's a tough slog
out
there.
It's not great. It's not a great situation. You know, in some ways, we've created a monster with social media. But and we've also, people aren't reading as much every year. The people who read declines. I mean, there's always going to be a core audience of readers, intense readers who read two or three books a week. But, you know, for someone who used to read a dozen books a year, now they're maybe reading five or six because of Netflix. because of YouTube, because of Facebook and Twitter. It's hard.
Yeah, it is hard. But you are, I mean, but what I noticed from your social online element is it's a very solid, attractive place. And I guess that's...
Well, thank you.
No, I'm not making it up. I mean, it's a, sort of my...
You never know.
Well,
you never know how much is too much promotion and how much is too little, because you can't measure it,
yeah,
as you well know.
Yeah.
You know, you throw something against the wall and you see what sticks.
Yeah. Do you write every day?
Not anymore. I'm not one of these people that writes 3 books a year.
Yeah.
Want to have a life?
Well, that would be James Patterson and his band of collaborators.
Yeah, I love James Patterson.
Who is?
In fact, I'm going to Vietnam in March, so I'll be gone for 3 weeks. And I've been wanting to go ever since, well, before I wrote Set the Line on Fire, ever since we lived through the late 60s.
Oh, that, I cannot even imagine. I mean, you must be anticipating that to spark all...
Yeah, I'm really psyched about it. And of course, I didn't, silly me, we planned the trip for like over a year.
Yeah.
And it's only in the last month that I realized I was going to write a book after I got back about the Vietnam War from the perspective of the Vietnamese.
Wow.
There's going to be two sisters. One is going to be, pregnant by a U.S. soldier, and the other one is going to be a Viet Cong fighter.
Oof. Ooh.
Yeah, that's going to be fun.
When is it going to be set?
That's a good question. I kind of wanted to set it in 68 because it was such a pivotal year.
Oh, God,
but
no kidding.
I have to get them to the U.S. Most of the refugees didn't come until 75.
Right.
So I'm trying to figure out which era to set it in.
Well, you know what a huge fan I am. I can't wait for that book. I can't wait for every one of your books.
Thank you.
You know, believe me. High Crimes is another great one. Georgia Davis is the...
I do have to say I was very proud of myself. I didn't use his name, the president's name, once in the book.
I noticed, and I think that is an incredible accomplishment, honey. An incredible accomplishment. Libby, stay warm. It's great to talk to you, and it's even better to read you. And enjoy that trip to Vietnam. I'm sure it will be life-altering.
Thank you.
Life-altering.
Thank you, dear. You are a very great interviewer. Love talking to you.
Well, you know, the whole thing is read the book. Read the book, and it becomes a breeze. And read all of your books, and it becomes even easier. Libby, it's always great to talk to you. Take care, hon.
You too.
Okay.